Session number 26879, Reel 1.
Hello there, Mr. Coxey. It's Joe Bryan. Regarding your book or whatever on the landing at Boulogne in 1940, I want to bring you a few more details. When we arrived, we had with us three kind of old-fashioned French guns. They were more like a farmer's plow. They couldn't be towed, they had to be manhandled with iron wheels and a metal seat for the operator to sit on. We loaded these on a flat-top truck and proceeded inland a little bit, then we turned towards the north. We stopped at a place which is elevated from the town, but it was just a kind of a lane, and in front of us we set the guns up, looking into a long green valley. There were two or three houses on the left on the side of the lane, but the grass and everything was beautiful to look at. Sergeant Green placed his two guns near two clumps of bushes that were indicated on the rough sketch. And I put mine near a wall to I don't know whether it was a meeting place for sportsmen or what. There was a nice green lawn inside, and there was a kind of a tower there. I think it might have been used as a broadcast tower one time or other. But it was right in the country where you would picture any road out of any English village. There was nothing on the right hand side of the view that we had looking down the valley, only a hillside. Now, we placed the two guns facing the valley, and Sergeant Green, the first day, nothing occurred. We didn't see anything. I memorized the valley. I could tell you every blade of grass almost. The only problem I made was the fact that I'd looked ahead all the time, never looked once from whence we had come, whether how to get back to the town. This lane eventually led to the town, but to where the 2nd Battalion was. The second day, I could hear the CSM from the 2nd Battalion instructing people to fire. There was a spotter plane overhead, and the amount of fire that went up there traced this boy. They really loaded that with shots. And, of course, the plane came down, and then there was a big cheer. That gave me an indication that that's probably where the rest of the battalion were, that part of the town, because we were elevated. I could look down and see that part. However, the following day, Sergeant Green, who'd been supplied with field glasses, had really scanned the area very carefully, and he reported Brian, there's a tank on there coming down the valley, and the tank was fired on by all three guns, and as it came towards us, it turned left, traveling up the hillside and over the top of the hill out of our range. And we didn't see anything else that day. Then the following morning, about midday again, Sergeant Green alerted us all to the tank that was coming down into the same track as the other one. But it came a little closer to us, and this was stopped. It was fired on by all three guns, and it was stuck there. Through these telescopic sights on these old guns, you could see very clearly that one of the occupants had got out and was on the opposite side of the tank. You could see it on his hands and knees crawling around to keep out of the fire. And that's all we had that day. Kind of monotonous job, just sitting there. But now, we never heard anything from the battalion. There's no communication whatever between the battalion and us. And we were a sergeant and two corporals and eight guardsmen. Now, the following morning, Green said the tank's been removed, but it had been removed during the night, but none of us had ever heard any movement of any kind of vehicle. It must have been a noise that we could have heard if we'd have been awakened or probably dozing off. However, about 2 hours later, Sergeant Green said, "Brian, they're assembling a gun by the side of the haystack," which I've indicated. I could see the haystack all right. But with his field glasses, he could see them assembling a field gun there. Now, the problem I have remembering this is the fact that I believe that time was time to go and leave the guns there to be blown up without our people. But Sergeant Green didn't say anything about it, but he just stayed there and was doing his job. About 2 hours after he told me that they were assembling a gun, there was a boom, 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 boom. And I looked over. We were about 20 yards away from his guns, and all the crew, sergeant and the crew, were all in pieces. What bothers me when I think about it is the battalion was going to withdraw that day, and why we weren't told of the possible withdrawal so we could have got out of there. There was a corporal Fowler. He was not in the line, the front line with us, but he was stationed in a concrete pillbox type of thing. It was behind the front, but I assumed that he was the contact man, either for incoming or outgoing messages, but we never received any message. Now, after this explosion, the two guardsmen on my gun ran down the lane, and there was all kinds of heavy German machine gun fire. I thought, well, I'll go to where this Corporal Fowler had been stationed for 3 days. I ran to his place, and I saw he had left. And which way he'd gone, I could tell by he went into a meadow and left quite a track in the meadow. So that's the way for me. However, after about 20 yards in the meadow, There was a different kind of a like more like a 303 gun fired, and it was hitting the wall and chipping the concrete stuff off the wall, and I thought it's just a random machine gun fire, so I moved further ahead, still trying to follow his track, and I lifted my head up to see, so I could get a better figure which way it went, and again there was 303 firing. So I decided that it was too dangerous to try any further, and I returned to the little blockhouse thing that where Fowler had been. And when I got there, I did feel a pain in my leg, and I thought I'd been shot, but it was a shard of concrete that had been removed from the wall and stuck through my left trouser leg and punctured my calf. I thought I'd better stay away from that area for a while, so I wrapped my leg with the field bandage that we carry with us, and it seemed to heal pretty quick. There was a bit of pain, but I thought I'd try later on to go down the lane where my two guardsmen had gone. However, I sat there for about 2 hours, and I must have dozed off. And it wasn't until the next morning that I got down, beautiful spring day, got down into the town, and I didn't know where I was supposed to walk to. However, I passed down the way down. I did pass a castle, an old castle. And as we were walking past there, there was another Tommy from the service corps, I think. And a French officer came to the edge of the wall and waved to us to go in. And as we went in, he pointed to a gun. He said, "There's a gun there. You can take turns manning it." Well, this alleyway led to a little room with no windows on the side facing the road. But there was windows on the back wall, but they were boarded up from the inside of the building. So we all slept there. There was four Belgian soldiers in there too. So we all slept there. And the next early next morning, there was a real blast. The German soldiers standing at the entrance had thrown these blast bombs in the alleyway. And what happened? It blew the windows that had been boarded from the opposite side out, and I looked down onto a mass of soldiers, all French, with backpacks all ready to go. And it looked like looking down on some soccer field, from the sand in the soccer field. That's how it was filled. But I thought later, why would the French officer wave us in there to man a gun when there was thousands of them, all packed ready to go? Anyway, that was the end of my tour of France. I was only the only Tommy plus the other one that I could find or see anywhere, and then we were marched to further north and further northern and west towards the border. And that's where we came together with some prisoners from Calais, and later on some from Dunkirk.
the French then, were, as they were walking past the villages, it was just amazing to see them kissing their wives goodbye and saying goodbye to them and joining the march to Germany, whatever. I couldn't understand that. And I had a feeling earlier on that I didn't think the French really wanted us there at the time. They wanted to get rid of that firing and get the hell out of there. And that's what I came to that conclusion. I couldn't speak French, but they didn't seem sympathetic at all. And what's bothered me ever since, well, for 60 years now, has bothered me. When was the order to withdraw made? Was it before that 2 o'clock in the afternoon when that six bursts of fire hit the two guns where Green was and they all perished? The lack of communication was atrocious. There was only 14 guys there away from the battalion, and there was no means of communication, none whatsoever. They left, I guess, about 4 hours before I got down there, because if I'd have known they were leaving, I'd have crawled down from where I was on my belly to get on the boat back to Britain. And that's bothered me. And 60 years ago, what the hell with it? Well, that's the information I have. I hope it's going to help you. This portion, of course, is not connected to Boulogne, but when further away from the coast, the Germans separated the French and the British, and the British were put into these cattle trucks and cattle trains, I guess. The ones you see on TV with all the Jews in there. That's the way we travelled, and there's about 30 or 40 in a boxcar, they call them. 30 or 40 in each one. No water, no food. And it took 3 days to travel from there to a place near south of Danzig. It was like an old fort, underground fort. That's where we ended up. But traveling there, shunting in every back street, every back siding, to make room for other traffic, 3 days and nights. And on one occasion, there was an inspector, German inspector, on the outside there, and they were asking for water. And then the German said, Churchill say, time on our side, time on our side. And by the time this train arrived at this location, it was near the River Vistula, there was two dead in one of the other coaches. And that's when you really felt the hunger, because you're dreaming about a slice of bread. And when they issued the soup, soup was just barley, boiled barley water, and bread was divided up by one small black bread loaf between five people. So you had a small slice of about an inch, and the soup. Now those two or three weeks in that camp were about the worst you could ever wish for. You slept on straw, and there was some airmen with me, some tank people, and from every department there, except I didn't find any Welshmen there, Welsh guards or any guards there. Now, from there, you were sent out to different parties. Maybe they'd take 20 or 30 people to a certain area to work, either on a farm or in some factory, not industrial factories, but like a dairy and stuff like that. Of course, then you could steal all the butter you needed, and things are better when you were working. But some were on the highway, building highways, and there was no relief from starvation there. Just work and work and grin and bear it. Some of the guards, some of them are really terrorists, but like every population, there were some good ones too. We had to make our own way of living, and what I found about the German guards, that we were at a place called Strasbourg in Poland, but it had a different Polish name. Of course, they Dutchized all the town names, and I tried to find them on the map, but the Polish people that I've met, they don't remember the names, because a place called Debenki in Polish became Benkenau, so that's another little village that I was at, that all the names are Germanized. But some of the guards, we were at one place called Strasbourg, I mentioned that, and that was near the old Polish and German border. And then this day we could see tanks and trucks and just going night and day past this camp. And some of us were working on the road, and we were asking the Germans, where are you going? Oh, we're going, they're going to let us through to attack India. That's what one of them said. And of course he said, we've got to keep this war going, because Churchill will fight till there's nothing left. However, it wasn't long after that when, of course, they attacked on the Eastern Front into Russia. And then we could see the difference in the guards. The guards weren't very young anymore. They were old fogies, and some of them were demons. Others were just like old fathers to us. But the one thing they didn't want any complaints from the prisoners, because if they got a lot of complaints, they'd move them and they'd be on the Russian front. They didn't want that. However, thinking back over the years, the best place to be when you're in a prison camp was probably working on a farm, because you had vegetables and You're all locked up in some little village and some house in the village, you know, locked up. But at least you could get a meal once a day, and the freedom was gone. But it was better to be on a farm. Now, after at one point we were in at a near a railway station, sorting, transferring material from one track to another, and we could see what was happening to the Russians, because all these death packages were coming through. You could tell by how many death packages we had to handle. They were like personal packages that had been sent to the wives, and they were all had to be moved to different train for further delivery. And at that camp, later on, near the end of the war, of course, you could hear the Russian front. We were about 20 miles from the Russian front, so half a dozen of us were sent to a big old house that the doctor, German doctors, were using for repairing the soldiers as they were coming in. And boy, those ambulances were coming just like a soccer match. In. And we were lifting them out and delivering to the doctors, and the doctors would get to work on them right away, throw a leg over to you to take it away, or an arm, or move a dead body, and we'd have to take it down the field at the back, and they'd be buried. And I've seen enough arms and legs by that time. And outside this camp, I remember, outside this house where we worked, was a German soldier. He was hanging from a tree, swinging there, and the words were like, "This is what happens to deserters." But I didn't see that anymore. Anyway, as the front came nearer, we were hoarded into the two or three old soldiers, their horse and wagon, and we followed them along the roads, and they were trying to keep ahead of the Russian front. And this is, of course, almost towards the end of the war. And finally we got to a place called Halle. And there was a big hospital there, and there were some American prisoners in this hospital. And we were like stationary. We didn't know where to go anymore. The old guys didn't know what to do with us. They couldn't feed us, and they couldn't direct us one way or the other. But while we were there, the American fighter plane came over, and there was a little train moving, and they blew that up, and I thought, well, we're not too far away from the front. Anyway, the next morning, coming down towards us was an American Jeep with two officers in. And were we ever glad to see those guys? They called on the radio, and within an hour or so, there was 8 or 10 big trucks there to pile in and take us further away to a big hospital they had for 3 or 4 days. And this hospital was American, run by the Americans, but as I said, the hospital was run by the Americans. And then they fed us all, guess what? Freshly baked bread. And the K-Russians, whatever they called them. Boy, were we pleased about that. And they said that they'd arrange transport for us the following morning. And we were going to fly into Brussels to the British fort there. So they arranged the trucks all took us to this little field where the old Dakotas landed, and they took 30 in each plane, and as they took off, they flew us over the town, and boy, oh boy, you've seen them all on TV, I guess, but there wasn't a roof on any of the buildings in the town there. And then we got